From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. Our topic on this edition of the program, Libyans go to the polls. Our guest, Jason Pack, a non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute, and that's a think tank here in Washington, a longtime Libyan observer. Jason Pack is also the author of the forthcoming book, Libya and the Global Enduring Disorder. Jason Pack is also founder of Libya Analysis LLC, a consultancy organization producing evidence-based analysis, forecasting, and commercial research on Libya. In 2015, he founded Eye on ISIS, a nonprofit monitoring organization, which details the group's history, its interactions with other jihadi actors, and Western actions toward the group. This year, he launched the Libya Security Monitor. His articles have appeared in the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Financial Times, and numerous other international publications. A little over 10 years since the NATO intervention in Libya, which helped topple longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi, Libyans will finally go to the polls. In March of this year, a government of national unity emerged with Prime Minister Abdul Hamid Dubaiba at the helm. This transitional administration unified two prior divided administrations in the East and West and was tasked with preparing for elections on December 24. According to The Economist magazine, in the last few years, Libya saw a high level of external involvement in the conflict between its eastern half, known as Cyrenaica, and the West, referred to as Tripolitania. Qatar and Turkey supported the former government of national accord in Tripoli, and the UAE, Bahrain, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia backed General Khalifa Haftar in the east, who attempted but failed to topple the government in Tripoli. Al Jazeera reports that the United Nations estimates that approximately 20,000 foreign fighters are still present in Libya. They range from Russians sent by the Kremlin-linked Wagner Group to African and Syrian mercenaries and Turkish soldiers. Meantime, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris heads to Paris next week to attend a Libya-focused conference organized by the United Nations, Germany, and Italy. On behalf of Washington, she is expected to send a strong message of support for the Libyan people as they move toward national elections and the eventual withdrawal of foreign forces and mercenaries from the country. Well, for more on the state of play in Libya and prospects for stability and elections, we are delighted to welcome Jason Pack, who joins us via Microsoft Teams. Jason, welcome back to the program.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And I'm delighted to welcome, as always, my colleague and in-house North Africa and Middle East expert, Mohamed El-Shenawy.
Thank you.
So, Jason Pack, you know, I want to step back a moment because there's a lot here to unpack, so to speak. Can you tell us, Jason, given your deep background, after 10 years since NATO involvement basically toppled Gaddafi, and 7 years since the last elections, we have roles of international actors, you know, the Russians and the UAE and so forth on one side backing General Haftar, you have the Turks and the Qataris backing Tripoli. What do we see going on? You know, we have a rush toward elections, but elections do not a democracy make. Give us a sense of where we are today and why, after so many years of UN intervention, mediation, has it taken so long to arrive to this day? And we don't even know if this is really going to augur a sense of stability and unity in that country.
Well, Carol, that's exactly right. You've conveyed to our listeners the sheer complexity of the Libyan conundrum, as well as Libya mirroring the enduring disorder which we're all living through globally. If we want to go back, I would nuance some of your presentation there and say there was not a NATO intervention in Libya. Rather, there was a NATO no-fly zone which supported nascent Libyan rebels, which had created a popular organization on the ground and spearheaded multiple uprisings. That was a rare moment where international coordination worked. However, since the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi, almost exactly 10 years ago, we have seen in microcosm in Libya the way that the international system is not capable of coordinating itself to reach optimal responses to complex problems. This insight of mine is to look at Libya as a problem set not so dissimilar to climate change or tax havens. Almost all countries have the same end goal when they're dealing with a problem like climate change. And the same is true about Libya. Everyone will benefit if a wealthy country like Libya is stable, creating jobs, investing in construction, and allowing guest workers to come to it. And everyone suffers if the country is in chaos, it exports arms, jihadis, and migrants. Yes, we have some slight differences. The Italians might want this oil deal. The French might want the ability to have troops in the south to fight jihadis. The Turks have one vision. The UAE has a more anti-Islamist vision. But we all share 95% of the vision. And yet, if you look back over the last 10 years of international interactions and policy towards Libya, we fight about the 2 or 3% of the differences rather than working on the 95% of the shared vision. And this has scuppered progress in the country.
Exactly. Well, that's a great analysis. And I hate to bring you back to earth in a sense, but as a result of the 5% of differences, they still present a major problem. So now that there is this government of national unity, which has been governing since March after the division of the country into these two rival camps with their respective backers, how has that government of national unity governed? Do they signal some kind of a hope or the same forces of division underlying the problem of getting to a more stable Libya?
Well, that's a crucial question to deal with the differentiation between a figment of progress and order and the underlying informal reality of disorder. And I think here again, Libya is an apt microcosm for other domains. Yes, the UN exists. We have a thing that purportedly does global governance. And it helped facilitate the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum, which culminated in the GNU government, which in theory is a government of all of Libya. But then if we dig deeper, the UN doesn't really function because the Russians veto anything that's against their interests. And the GNU was put in place through a series of potentially corrupt actions. There might have been some bribery behind the scenes. And then what do you know? Once in power, it doesn't really unite the Eastern and Western factions. And it didn't eliminate the House of Representatives, the former parliament, which has overstayed its mandate and is ruled with an iron fist pretty much by Aguila Saleh, the Speaker of the House, who wants to do anything to spoil and make sure that he can stay in power. So he didn't pass the elections law the way that the UN had mandated he was supposed to. And he's constantly tinkering at the edges about who can run, when parliamentary elections will be different than presidential elections, all to keep the importance of the HOR, the House of Representatives, so that he doesn't have to cede any power to the GNU, whose budget he also blocked, so they don't have the ability to repair oil pipelines or get electricity to regular Libyans. And I think this is a great microcosm of ways to analyze developments at a larger level. Yes, it's great. We hear about progress at something like COP26 in Glasgow about climate change, or Biden goes to Europe for a NATO summit. And then it's like, great, they talked about all the things they're going to do together, but where's the implementation? And the reality is that none of these global governance institutions have the ability to impose penalties. They're very good at carrots. They're very good at, you know, doing the talking shop thing. But when push comes to shove to deal with recalcitrant actors like Russia and China or mercenaries, we've not seen an ability for people to get tough and hard to face these challenges and ostracize the enemies of collective progress.
Well, speaking of enemies of collective progress, I'm sure my colleague Mohamed El-Shanawi has some questions for you on that score.
Jason, how did regional and international intervention in Libya resemble the title of your new book, Libya and the Global Enduring Disorder?
Well, it mirrors it. If Gaddafi, who had ruled for 42 years, died or was ousted by a popular rebellion in the Cold War, we would not have had an enduring disorder in terms of foreign interventions in the post-Gaddafi era. We certainly wouldn't have had France and Italy on opposite sides of the same civil war. And it's worth taking a moment back to reflect on how crazy that is. Because in the Cold War era, no environment was unimportant enough for both Russia and America to seek to order it. And America ordered its allies. And whether we made the right interventions or wrong interventions, they were what were decided in Foggy Bottom and the Pentagon and the White House. Just look at Iraq. America made a decision. The American allies either sat out like Germany and France, or they got on board like the UK. We didn't have the French supporting one Iraqi militia while the Germans supported the opposite Iraqi militia. That's only possible now in this post-Cold War era, which I term the enduring disorder. And if we look at this from an even longer historical perspective, in the past, when one empire falls, another one rises. And this gets at the IR theorist's view about the balance of power. But we're not seeing that now. It's not like when the British Empire said we're withdrawing east of Suez and the American Empire picked up all those commitments. America is withdrawing globally, and we don't have the Chinese stepping into the major hotspots. What is China doing to order Ukraine? Where is China in Syria? They're absent, and they're completely absent in Libya. And that's why the Russians and Turks have mercenaries on opposite sides of a conflict. The UAE and Qatari support different factions. And as America is trying to pass this resolution or trying to help out, we're not even coordinating our policies successfully with our own allies, the UK and Italy, France, and other NATO countries.
So what kind of political stability could Libya achieve while Russian mercenaries are still backing the so-called Libyan National Army, while Turkey is militarily backing the Tripoli government?
Well, as all Libyans know, they can't wait for foreigners to sort out their problems. Libya can achieve a modicum of stability, fortunately, because it's a wealthy country that's sparsely populated and lacks sectarian divides. If Libyans, through this political process, which is mediated by the UN, or their own political process, would be willing to put aside their tiny differences and say, we need stability, we need to be exporting oil, and we need to be spending our money getting education and electricity to the Libyan people, I think stability is just around the corner. And that's why Libya is a different situation than Syria or Yemen, which are frankly very difficult to sort out because they lack the money and they have sectarian divisions. Libya is a test case that's winnable, but we need a combination of Libyans putting aside their tiny differences and then the Western bloc, whether it's led by the U.S. or a coalition, saying, okay, we're going to impose minor sticks and major carrots on bad actors. And it's important to point out that the Biden administration is enormously respected in Libya, and they don't have to do much to really take the reins of coordinating the allies.
But Libyan Foreign Minister Najla Al-Mangoush said that there is a real danger of a civil war arising after the upcoming elections. Is that a legitimate concern?
I think in this instance, Foreign Minister Mangoush has hit the nail on the head. I have always believed that there will be a civil war after the elections because the way they're constructed, the initial first round of the presidential elections doesn't culminate in a president unless he gets a majority. Well, if there are nine candidates running, no one is going to get over 50%. And then in the delay until the runoff, I mean, if there even is going to be a runoff, many spoilers, as well as those who won but are afraid that they would lose in the second round, will act militarily to cement what they perceive as their gains. And this is an example of the enduring disorder because we've ended up with this election system by delegating to the defunct parliament that only 19% of registered voters actually voted for that parliament how to construct these elections. And that's absurd because a coalition of the major internationals needed to step in and say, this is how the election is going to be. And if you don't like it, we're declaring the HOR long past its sovereignty and it's no longer valid in international law. And we won't allow it to act as Libya and receive payments. I mean, I've long been of the belief that no body in Libya has sovereignty as per international law, and hence shouldn't be able to transact business or receive payments into the central bank as if they were Libya. So the internationals hold all the cards, but they don't use them because they can't coordinate them between the Russians and the Turks and all of these complexities. Unfortunately, Foreign Minister Mangoush is right for this once about the impending civil war, which internationals could stop if they laid down the law of what the implications will be for actors who use violence.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jason Pack. He's non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute here in Washington and author of the forthcoming book, Libya and the Global Enduring Disorder. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook. at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Paul Ngonga from Nairobi, Kenya. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or follow us on Twitter and like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to Jason Pack talking about Libya. Jason, you just said that the international community, you know, really holds all the cards in terms of Libya's stability, in a sense, its upcoming elections. As we said earlier, Vice President Kamala Harris will be in Paris next week for this international conference, the focus of which will be to support Libya. But talk about if the United States and the EU, all of its parties, you know, even those who were on opposing sides earlier, the French, the Italians, do the United States and the EU countries see eye to eye on Libya? And what about Turkey and the Gulf states who supported this General Haftar and the Russians? How do they see this moment? Is everybody more or less aligned, or is this just sort of kabuki theater?
Well, it's kabuki theater. And I would say in that way, it mirrors what's happened at COP26 or treaties about tax havens. And that's why I see Libya as the correct microcosm within which to investigate the global enduring disorder. And that's what I put forth in my book. So we have no indication that major sticks will be used to penalize spoilers. And that's not the goal of this conference in Paris. Macron has been trying to assert that Libya is a part of the Maghreb, a traditional area of influence for France, and that French interests should be able to mediate and coordinate. So rather than working with Italy or London or Washington, he wants to be the one hosting the conference and pushing, for example, the candidate, whether it's Fathi Bashagha or Arif Nayyad, that he wants. And he'd like the electoral process to be structured in a way that will lead to a pro-French outcome. And that's exactly the wrong way of looking at things. To talk about the agency that we have as individuals and that Libyans have, we can rally behind consensus ideologies when we vote in our local and national elections, say, what I care most about is that we work across the aisle and that we work globally on global solutions. I, for example, care much more about global governance than about my tax rate. And I think that there's a possibility for young people who do care about things like climate change to have a very different ideological engagement. And this may be the case increasingly as new forms of ideological engagement arise and lead to a different kind of global agenda.
Well, that's very fascinating. And let's go back to Libya itself, not just as a microcosm of what's going on in the globe, but to what extent we can see any hope. Will the elections, in your view, take place on December 24th? What about the status of foreign fighters who are supposed to be leaving? You know, where does that stand? Does that happen before or after or during the elections? What are your thoughts?
The foreign fighters are definitely not going to be gone by December 24th. There was a, you could call it a peace treaty or a ceasefire agreement on October 23rd, 2020, which has largely held in terms of keeping the peace, but it didn't succeed in getting the foreign fighters out. There's no more levers to get the foreign fighters out at present. Elections in some form or another appear like they are going to happen on December 24th, but they won't be decisive. They'll be just presidential and not parliamentary. They'll be just the first round. They're unlikely to produce a winner. Is it a step in the right direction? It might be. I am, you know, happy and pleased that people are able to rally behind the idea of elections and bringing change, and the Libyan people seem broadly behind the idea of elections. So, you know, we need to take small victories and say that amidst this enduring disorder, actions that policymakers and people take can matter. What could happen now in the lead up to those elections that would be very, very useful is for international actors to spell out what they will do if the elections don't happen, or what they will do to Aguila Saleh at the HOR if he tries to fiddle with the rules or prevent the second round from happening. If those penalties for spoilers are clearly spelled out, there's just the possibility that real elections might culminate in a new president, and that that president could be supported by a plurality of the Libyan people.
So, Jason, I want to follow up on that in the few minutes we have left. In terms of a consensus leader, can you tell us about the candidates who are in the running? It's only about a little bit more than a month away, should the at least the presidentials take place on time. And what about the son of Muammar Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam? I mean, is he in fact going to pose as a candidate? You know, what about this Gaddafi nostalgia?
Well, there is quite a bit of what's called the Green Movement, or what you've termed Gaddafi nostalgia, and they are important players, primarily monetarily, but then to some extent demographically in Libya. The reason we don't know the candidates who will be running is the electoral process has been so fraught and so feuded over that no one can assert who can determine who can be a candidate or not. And none of the candidates want to announce themselves until the last moment so as not to get detractors. Things are going to have to come to a head very quickly. What we do know is that the main contenders are Fathi Bashagha, the former interior minister who hails from Misrata, frequently seen as a moderate, willing to work with the East and Haftar, but also the one who defended Tripoli from Haftar's assault in 2019-2020. He has some flaws in the way that he's presented himself, but he also could be a coherent figure and has good relationships with the U.S. Then there's Arif Nayyad, the former Libyan ambassador to the UAE, who brings a kind of anti-Islamist approach, but he has a PhD and is very intellectual and has the ability to present himself as able to mediate between that green movement and certain other elements like his Warfalla tribe. We have others connected to the current prime minister, Abdelhamid Dabaiba, who either Dabaiba himself might try to run or his brother-in-law and cousin, Ali Dabaiba, associated with the former Gaddafi regime and a lot of corruption. He might try to run. Haftar himself could try to run, Saif al-Islam or other Gaddafi-connected candidates. It's a smorgasbord of candidates who are likely to all throw their hats in the ring and then very quickly make deals among themselves, transferring their support blocks to each other in exchange for handouts and power positions should the person they're backing win. And that all has to happen in a kind of lightning round in late November, December. But generally, we see the front runner as either Fathi Bashagha or the Dabaibas. And therefore, those are just status quo candidates who are unlikely to be able to govern Libya or really do the reform to its semi-sovereign institutions that create the incentives to join a militia anyway.
And Jason, you said that you're not expecting a great deal from the Paris conference, but what about other countries like Russia and some of the other Gulf countries that have been supporting rival groups like Haftar? And by the way, I'd like to get your view on his role, if any, in the elections. Which countries do you see as most problematic as impediments in terms of Libya's unification?
Just as it's difficult for the international community to name and shame who's to blame in Libya, a lot of the countries say the right things. They verbally support the elections. The UAE has been very good on supporting the GNU verbally. Even Russia and Turkey, who are probably less supportive of the electoral process, they mouth the right platitudes. They're spoilers, and they're clearly not invested in the electoral process. Egypt and Turkey and Russia have really benefited from the Dabaiba regime because they're getting their back payments taken care of. They're getting some new construction deals. So they're happy for things to just continue as they are, for the elections to either happen or not happen or be indecisive, because then Dabaiba and the GNU camp will stay in power. What are the implications of all of this? Again, everyone wants to pose that they're the one who either is mediating the electoral process, as the French are trying to pose, or that they are somehow negotiating between the different sides, as the Egyptians and Emiratis frequently pose themselves as. What no one is able to achieve, because they don't really invest the political capital, is getting the international actors on the same page and saying who will be punished if they derail the elections and how that punishment will be meted out. And again, this is exactly analogous to climate change. If the US, China, Russia, and the EU said anyone who violated these emissions targets cannot trade with us in this way or has to pay a fine or some kind of carbon tax, or we simply won't allow travel from that country, you could just imagine people would snap into line instantaneously. But we're in an era where it's easier to mouth platitudes than it is to throw down the law and get enforcement on things like tax havens and climate change, or even something that should be arguably simple, like getting elections in Libya.
What about the role of the United Nations?
So I've kind of avoided talking about the United Nations because symbolically they're important in Libya, but they're entirely dysfunctional. The current envoy, Jan Kubisch, doesn't seem to understand the economic drivers of the conflict in Libya. So he's focused on a lot of these political process issues, but has missed what's actually going on. And then he only has the power that the member states give him. So when the member states like Russia don't give him power to sort out issues, he's a talking shop, and the UN is underfunded and really lacks the ability to use the sticks that I've mentioned. So yes, the UN is symbolically important, but they don't really control the process. The UN can only work when the P5 nations are on the same page and are willing to deploy sanctions and not just threats.
Well, let me turn to Mohammed.
Yes, two major candidates for the presidential elections, namely General Haftar and Saif al-Qazafi, are known to be divisive figures. How could that impact the future of a united Libya if either one became the president of Libya?
Well, I'm going to slightly reframe your question. I don't believe that General Haftar or Saif al-Islam are major candidates for the election. General Haftar was the most powerful person in Libya in the beginning of 2019 after he retook the Fezzan and controlled the Sharara oil field as well as all of Libya's east. He had about 90% of Libya's oil under his thumb and 60% of its territory. When he launched the war for Tripoli and then lost and failed to get sufficient Emirati or Russian support to maintain his dominance over various regions, he became a spent force. He's in his late 70s. He's very ill. His sons are unpopular with even his own constituents. So he's not going to win an election to be president of Libya. He turns off more people than he turns on. And his core supporters sometimes would prefer someone like Aguila Saleh or Saif al-Islam. Then if we turn to Saif al-Islam, yes, there is some nostalgia for the Qaddafi period, but he also turns off more people than he turns on. And he hasn't reemerged publicly. He did an interview with the New York Times where he miscalculated how the media from that would play out, and it hasn't played out very well. He also hasn't been able to unite himself with other constituencies. So he's not a serious candidate. The serious candidates are those status quo candidates in the West, like Bashagha and the Dubaibas. Potentially Arif Nayyad as a unifying factor is a serious candidate, although he doesn't have as much domestic support as the others, but he is more articulate on the global stage. Haftar and Saif al-Islam also have the problem of being accused of war crimes or the lawsuit in Virginia against Haftar or the ICC issues that Saif would face. So I don't think they can really win, let alone maybe there are aspects of the electoral law as written that prevent them from running. Keep in mind that Haftar is a dual citizen having an American passport, which prevents him from running as per the current law. And Saif is facing this ICC warrant that also prevents him from running.
And before we close, let me just ask you, Jason, if you'd like to read a short excerpt from your book that illustrates not only the enduring disorder in Libya, but how it actually illustrates the global disorder that we're seeing.
Thank you, Carol. Libya's chaos interacts with the fallout from the COVID pandemic and illustrates crucial facets about the current state of the world, the political implications of globalization of a particular form of neoliberal capitalism, the implications of America's retreat from the burdens of global hegemony, and the failure of the West to enshrine its Cold War victory into new global coordination bodies, the way that the victory in the Second World War was institutionally cemented. Like a funhouse mirror, therefore, the closer we look at Libya, the more we see that the salient dynamics of the wars of post-Qaddafi succession reflect selective distortions of the key features of our evolving international system and the post-pandemic world. In Libya, as elsewhere, we have simultaneously more of a need for global governance than ever before, and ironically, less global governance than at any time in modern history. This current trend line, as well as historical parallels, suggests a seemingly bleak upcoming decade or two, independent of how the Biden administration or its successors approach global leadership. Multipolarity or a rebalancing of powers will not automatically follow from the decline in America's power. Just as the ensuing power vacuum in Libya in the wake of Qaddafi's ouster has not, by some cosmic law, elicited either the creation of a new durable organizing force to fill the void or incentivize the dominant outside power to provide order. There are various indicators that the world has become increasingly Libyanized by becoming thoroughly penetrated by the key features of the enduring disorder. Developments in key nodes like Libya or Ukraine produce and emit the violence, hot money, ideology, and media polarization that feed our new era. Welcome to the enduring disorder.
Jason Pack is non-resident fellow at the Middle East Institute. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Libya and the Global Enduring Disorder. Jason, thank you so much for your time, for your insights on the upcoming elections, what's at stake overall in Libya, not just for Libya, but for the region and for the world. We greatly appreciate it.
Always fun to share these insights with you, Carol and Mohammed. Hope to talk soon.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.